does Christ's kingdom owe to the culture of the Roman Empire? In Rome's Age of Revolution, Augustus, Empire, and the Making of Christianity, Tim Whitmarsh gives his answer. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm pleased to say Tim joins me now to discuss his new book. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's get into Rome's Age of Revolution first. What had Rome been before it emerged as this vast, consolidated empire under a single ruler?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I think there are two transformations that we need to be thinking of here. One is the transition, political transition of Rome from a republic to that of what was in effect an imperial system, a monarchical system, although Augustus himself, who was the first of these monarchs, these rulers, wouldn't have agreed with that. He presented himself as a continuator of the republic. But in effect, it was corralling all power and all decision-making and shunting it upwards and pushing it into the lap of one man in particular. So that was the political revolution, but there was also a spatial revolution because Augustus's, or the future emperor Augustus's, victory at the Battle of Actium in 31 BCE united the Mediterranean under one rule. That had never happened in the past. And that began the process that created the largest empire the world had ever seen. So it's two transitions, one, if you like, geopolitical, and the other in terms of the political constitution of Rome itself.
Could you give a brief insight into the character of that Augustan age and Augustus's character himself?
Well, that's a great question that really gets into the heart of the issue. Before the Battle of Actium, before all this power was vested in him, Augustus was a thug. He was a warlord. He was the adopted son of Julius Caesar, who'd been a hugely powerful, influential figure in the previous generation. So he was one of a number of people who were vying, using any technique possible, for the position of de facto top dog at Rome. Of course, at that stage in the Republic, they didn't have a political position of being the ruler of Rome, but they were all these people like Mark Antony and so forth. They were all vying for that top position. But when he assumed the, as I say, de facto position of emperor, then a kind of transformation came over him. And whether this was something that had always been latent in him or whether it was simply very adept propaganda, but he refashioned himself as this incredibly consensual individual. He called himself primus inter pares, first amongst equals, a phrase that we still use today. So he acknowledged that he was the most important one, but he said we're all equal in a way. He made a lot of effort to demonstrate his, if you like, collaborative nature. He started presenting himself in very modest dress. He introduced laws that suggested that sexual morality should be regulated and so forth. So he really transformed himself into something that looked much more, if you like, a traditional Roman. But as I say, in effect, that was skin deep. Everybody knew that the real muscle when it came to decision making lay with him. He was the father of the fatherland. That was the title that he took on.
So there's this sense, isn't there, that Rome was experiencing the rebirth of an older order, but also enjoying the best of the very new. What does that say about the character of his revolution?
Yes, I mean, it would be really interesting to do a comparative study of how people across the ages have managed such revolutions, because Augustus's choice was to proclaim, as he did on coinage, the Republic has been restored. He presented himself as somebody who was returning to roots at the same time as transforming the city unrecognizably. So architecturally, for instance, the Rome that we can visit today, I was in Rome last week, actually, we wander around the city with its extraordinary monuments. Of course, many of them, those are post-classical, but the classical ones really do, by and large, belong to the age of Augustus and following. So he really was, he pulled off a masterstroke. He created a revolution under the guise of restoring traditional values.
And what role did poetry play? I mean, Virgil's Aeneid is an immensely sophisticated work of political ideology on the one hand, but also of kind of creating imaginative space, political space? How did Virgil and the kind of broader culture play a role?
That's a very acute observation. We need to dial back a little bit when we think about literature in this era. It's not necessarily, it is an elite phenomenon, but it's not what rich people do in their downtime, relaxing with a play or an opera or a book on the sofa or whatever. Literature really was a vehicle for ideology, and it was Virgil's Aeneid, which was published in 19 BC, was an absolutely transformative text. And within a generation, we can see graffiti scrawled on the walls of Pompeii, for example, with quotes and sometimes adapted quotes, subtly adapted quotes from the Aeneid. So it clearly was the poem of empire, if you like. It was the founding text of a new era. Now, Rome's relationship with literature was not deep. Literary culture, I mean, it's silly to put dates on things, but literary culture really began in Rome 200 years earlier with plays that were adaptations of Greek plays. But the big surge forward had been in the previous century, in the first century BCE, when you begin to get figures like Cicero and Lucretius and Julius Caesar himself writing works of literature that, in a sense, translate the Greek classics into a modern Roman idiom. Virgil did that by taking on the most canonical Greek author, Homer, and Homer's Iliad and Odyssey really were the foundation stone, not just of Greek literature, but of Greek society generally. They were, the closest analogy is to the Bible or to the Quran in Muslim, in Christian or Muslim countries. It was that central. It was what school children learned. It was what any time you reached for an example, you would reach for an example in the poetry of Homer. So Virgil took this stuff over and transformed it and translated it into a new age, and it became the epic of a new era. And the big trick that Virgil pulled, as you say, it's a terribly sophisticated text with many dimensions to it, but the big trick that he pulled was, whereas the Iliad had told the story of the Greeks' victory over the Trojans, now in Virgil's Aeneid, the Trojans, their descendants become the Romans, and they become the world conquerors. So the defeated have been transformed into the victors, a paradoxical reversal of a kind which we see all across the empire at this time.
Yeah, and you can see that in the text. In the first half of the poem, Aeneas is confronted with scenes of the Trojan War. He's kind of looking backwards. And then in the second half, broadly speaking, he's confronted with imaginative pictures of what happens in the future. So there's some change that Aeneas goes through, I guess, that mirrors the kind of transformation that Virgil was thinking that Rome has gone through.
Yeah, and the sophistication of Virgil is that whilst it is a deeply Augustan, deeply ideological poem, it also has many other aspects to it. So the civil war that had been ripping apart Rome in the previous century, thanks to people like Julius Caesar, which Augustus claimed to have put an end to, that is narrated in that second half of the Aeneid, because Aeneas lands in Italy and he has to fight Italians for control of the city. And it's a brutal process. So even as Virgil proclaims the magnificence of the Augustan project, he's always making you aware of the, if you like, the damage that the bulldozer has created in order to build the new city.
How would elite, and indeed ordinary citizens of this new Rome, have conceived of the great spaces of Augustus's world, the cities dotted around it, the land and the oceans, you know, this great consolidated empire?
Well, in the city of Rome itself, that the connectivity that came with empire would have manifested itself in terms of goods and product and enslaved people and ideas coming from all over the world. Empire is always this, what I call this swirling system. Empires create mobility, rapidity, and appetite for change. And Rome itself, we have witnesses from the late first century, early second century, marveling at the number of things you can buy from all over the world in this great port city of Rome, or at least close to a port. Probably the transformation would have been bigger outside of Rome itself, where in a traditional city like Alexandria or Athens or Antioch, suddenly any illusion of independence was gone, and you were part of a new system, and that created tensions and complex identities, if you like, as a newly Romanized elite managed to internalize Roman ideas whilst also remaining, as they saw it, true to Greek ideas. But the really interesting places, I think, are the newly connected places. So one of the places that I spend a lot of time in the book is the Anatolian Plateau, which is the Anatolia, which is modern Turkey, is ringed by a set of mountains, particularly on the in the western and southern parts of it. So that there has this plateau in the center, which was pretty inaccessible, and it was a byword for wildness and difficult terrain and bandits and the like. Augustus created, or at least his minions created, new routes into the plateau and joined up these cities that had formerly been tiny places that suddenly burst alive with economic and intellectual energy. And it was places like this really that were the first places that Christian mission went to, the newly connected places that didn't really have a history.
Yeah, just before we get into the Christian story, I mean, I love these concepts that you thread throughout the text, this swirl idea, this constant movement and reformulation. But you also talk about the paradox of empire, of the Roman Empire. What did you mean by that?
What I mean by that is we've touched on this already. Empire is can't be sustained, I think, without a kind of cognitive dissonance. Everybody knows that empires are extractivist. Everybody knows that there are winners and losers in the game of empire. But the ideology that is required to sustain this enormous conceit, if you like, that everywhere in a particular geographical frame should be subordinate to one city, that requires ideological gymnastics, if you like, that are incompatible with the basic truths that one knows about the extractivism of empire. So at its very heart, empire is a paradox. And as I see it, the intellectual labor of sustaining that paradox creates the space for other forms of paradox as well. So, you know, who was it who said the great thing about capitalism is that it takes revolution and it packages it and it sells it back to you. That sort of phenomenon is going on in every single imperial system, whereby people try to resist it, but the resistant energy is absorbed by the center and sent out again. And conversely, forms of imposition, if you like, forms of imperial muscle have a knock-on effect in other parts of the world where people mimic them and they transform them and so forth. So it's the grandiosity of vision of empire, which I think has this hugely paradoxical set of effects. It's not just a system for imposing power on other people. It's also a form of expression, a form of aesthetics, if you like, that creates energy and excitement and new ways of thinking about the world.
I think just as you were talking, I thought about maybe the best way to get a grip of that paradox is the Aeneid, that moment where Aeneas grasps the golden bough. You know, this kind of strange moment of fragility and power and strength. And there's you know, kind of, there are many moments in the Aeneid where that paradox becomes, you know, kind of explicable and easy to attain for the reader.
I think that's right. I mean, we keep coming back to the Aeneid, such an extraordinary poem, because whilst it is this poem that holds together the paradox, it says that, I mean, that Rome is new and old simultaneously. It is a newly insurgent city that is dominant over the world in Virgil's own lifetime, whilst also having these deep roots as going back to the first wave of immigrants to the Italian shore, refugee immigrants coming over in small boats to the Italian shores, creating a new environment, a new kind of, so past and present are linked together by these really powerful bonds in it. But at the same time, so that's the ideological message of empire, if you like. The new has traces of the old in it. The new is legitimized and authorized by the old. But at the same time, as you say, it's full of a sense of human fragility. Aeneas, pious Aeneas, as he's called throughout, is not this Achilles-like superhero warrior who is never beset by doubts or whatever. Aeneas is always a doubting figure. He's actually more modeled on another epic figure, Jason, in the Jason and the Argonaut story, which was a Hellenistic Greek story. Somebody who's always questioning himself. And as you say, the fragility of the golden bough is one image of that. Another is the most famous, perhaps, image of his fragility is when he falls for the Carthaginian queen Dido, and it looks as if he's going to found his new city in North Africa, and he's going to be the founder of Carthage, which is traditionally Rome's enemy. And he's really smitten with Dido, but he's forced by the gods to leave her, and that catalyzes her suicide. And it's a terribly sad, tragic end. And it's another of these moments where you realize that to build, it's not just a question that you need to break some eggs to cook an omelette. It's also a really decisive weighing of the costs, I think, of, what is empire worth it? Can we really put all of our enthusiasm behind this imperial project when it is so catastrophic and calamitous?
Yeah, he's sort of the hero who looks back, but is sort of propelled forward. I think we got a good picture of that kind of culture. So, how did the first generations of Christians respond to that culture and that culture of empire?
Yeah, so to be clear, the first generations of Christians, as I see it, are not Jesus and his followers in Galilee. They are not Christians. They're part of an entirely Jewish world. It's only when Christianity explodes onto the Roman scene that it becomes Christian. And that's partly a trick of language, that Christianus is a Latin word, although probably not used in the early days, probably at the end of the first century CE. But it's partly also because, as far as we can tell, with the Gospels themselves are products of a later era, looking back to that first era. So we don't have any direct testimony of what Jesus himself and his followers thought. We only have this later reconstruction of it. But as far as we can tell, the Jesus followers, the followers who gathered themselves around Jesus, were not necessarily looking to proselytize across the world. It was a intra-Judean phenomenon. So it's when figures like Paul, and Paul, of course, is the key figure here because he may well have been a Roman citizen, as we're told in Acts of the Apostles, understood the new opportunities created by this connected world, the opportunities for practical forms of proselytizing, let's say roads and letters and so forth. These were practical things that you could use to help build your movement, but also the symbolic value of moving away from the local into more universalizing modes of thought. That was really, I think, what drove Christianity as a sort of, if you like, a kind of a second wave phenomenon, something that was rooted in and inspired by Jesus's teaching, but actually really taking seed in an entirely different environment, the interconnected environment of the Augustan Empire.
And that journey takes us back to the Anatolian plateau. Could you just elaborate how that affects Paul?
Yep. So Paul has two sets of letters to the Galatians, or two letters to the Galatians, rather. The Galatians are a people who are associated with the Anatolian plateau. Acts of the Apostles tells the story of this. So we have Paul's letters. We don't know the, except what's in the letters. We don't have any, if you like, any narrative architecture to sustain them. But Acts of the Apostles tells the story, and it may not be entirely true. Who knows? It doesn't really matter. But it's clear that Paul and his followers did make expeditions into the Anatolian Plateau. And Acts of the Apostles tells that the first story was on a road which had been constructed under Augustus. So 50 years earlier, this journey would have been impossible. It tells how they made land at Perge in southern Anatolia and worked their way up along this road, which, as I say, made the practical side of traveling so much easier. These are really well-constructed roads that are designed to bear chariots and so forth. He stops off at these newly Romanized cities on the way. cities like Iconium, for example, which would go on within a generation or two, would go on to become a really important, huge city in that area. Yes, as I say, the roads that he followed simply didn't exist 50 years earlier. So Paul's mission was in a direct consequence of Augustan imperialism.
So there's this kind of spatial element, but what about time? And I'd love you to explore the kind of tantalizing parallels that you draw in the text between the celebration of, on the one hand, Augustus's providential rise to power and the stories of Christ's birth on the other.
Yeah, so the first half of the book really is about two acts of daring remaking, if you like, the space we've discussed, and the other is time itself. And it's a bit mind-bending sometimes to modern readers to think of time as something that you can play tricks with. But in fact, the minute we start thinking about calendars, for example, the fact that different religions use different calendars and so forth, it's quite clear that the way that we express time, the way that we measure time, the way that we experience time as human subjects is something that is culturally variable. Now, Augustus was, as I mentioned earlier, he was the adopted son of Julius Caesar, who had reinvented the calendar and in effect created the calendar that we still use today. It was tweaked a little bit in the Middle Ages, but it is in effect the calendar that we use today, with 12 months and months of variable numbers of days and so forth, and intercalated years and days every 4 years, that kind of thing. That's the Gregorian version of the Julian calendar. So yes, we've got this new calendrical system. Augustus rolls that out over the empire. He also places a lot of weight on his own birthday. And there's a series of inscriptions that are big, high-profile inscriptions being, if you like, sort of monumental acts of writing that are also decrees, that are also ways of taking up space and taking up the attention of local citizens, big statements of ideology, if you like. This type of decree is rolled out over Anatolia, which is modern Turkey, which emphasized that from now on, Augustus's birthday will be celebrated, because Augustus brought what this inscription calls the good news, the euangelion, which is the same word as the Christian Gospels, brought the good news. So as a result, we will be celebrating Augustus's birthday as the new year. So it's a really phenomenally ideological way of remaking time. Every new year is a re-beginning, a replaying of, if you like, the Augustan Revolution. So there's that side of things. There's the heavily ideologized side of Roman imperialism. And then, of course, in the Gospels, which are a fair amount later, we get the nativity story, of course, which is centered on Jesus's birth, the birth of a child. I'll come back to Augustus and the birth of Augustus. We also get this idea of the good news. And we also get this idea of going into a new age, the idea that we are now, with Jesus's birth, we are opening up a new era, a break with the past, which is also, of course, paradoxically a continuation of the past, because Christianity is a fulfillment, if you like, of Jewish prophecy in the Hebrew Bible. So we see in all sorts of interconnected ways, we see the same temporal paradox. We see the announcement of some child who will bring a new hope and a new courage and a new vision and a new peace to the world. All of these ideas are woven up in Augustan as well as Christian propaganda, but that novelty is itself rooted in the past and is presented as a kind of tradition. So just to finish up on that, the point that I didn't make was about the stories about Augustus's own birth, which have these eerie parallels with the stories of Jesus's birth. In particular, there's a kind of massacre of the innocents story around Augustus's birth, which parallels the massacre of the innocents in Matthew.
And also it appears in Virgil, to return to Virgil again, Virgil's eclogues.
Ah, yes, yes. Well, so before Augustus came to power and before Virgil wrote the Aeneid, he was already a premier poet of Rome. And He wrote his first collection of poems was called the Eclogues, not a very familiar word in English, but these were poems on a pastoral theme. So poems of shepherds, usually shepherds who live in an idyllic world which is gradually being impinged on by Romanization and by settlements of Roman veterans and so forth. So it's a fragile pastoral world. But in the fourth of his eclogues, Virgil's persona says, I'm now going to sing a higher song. And he starts singing this prophecy that a child will be born and that this child will be will settle all of the conflicts, and we're going into a new golden age, which is a familiar Greco-Roman idea that there was a golden age, then the silver age, and then so forth, and that there's a sort of cycles of ages, and the golden age, of course, is the very best. So it's again, it's a prophecy that a child will be born who will transform the world. Now, to cut a very long story short, because it's very complicated, the philology behind it, I try and do it in a kind of accelerated way in the book. But there are a lot of things going on here. One is that this poem itself, I believe, and others believe as well, is inspired by Jewish messianic prophecies, which themselves may have Egyptian roots. So that's the swirl of empires, that nothing originates in one place, that people are always borrowing ideas from another person. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is that this announcement of the child probably refers to a potential daughter or a potential a child of Mark Antony and Octavia, who've just got married at this particular point. And in fact, that relationship doesn't go anywhere. They don't have any children and so forth. So it's a sort of failed prophecy at that level. But the fourth eclogue has an afterlife, a double afterlife. One is that Virgil himself rewrites it in the Aeneid, where, of course, it prophesies Augustus, which is a bit paradoxical, because when the eclogue was published, Augustus was already alive, so couldn't really have been a foretelling of his life. But, this is the kind of a manipulation that ideology depends upon. And of course, in later antiquity, the poem was seen as a foretaste of, even amongst the pagans, a foretelling of the coming of Jesus Christ. So you have these sort of really powerful moments like this incredibly unusual poem that Virgil flags as unusual. He says, we're going to sing a different kind of song now. And he calls it a Cumaean song, a Sibylline song, a prophetic song. We've got this extraordinary new kind of poetry, which feeds into, which it doesn't mean anything in itself, but it creates a new way of thinking. We've got children who are about to be born, who are going to be transformative of the world. And again, it sort of creates the space, the ideological space for both for Augustinism, with its celebration of Augustus's birth and the transformative power of the new age, and creates the space for, I think, the acceptance of Christianity as a religion born in, with the message of innovation on traditional themes, thanks to the birth of a child.
It's fascinating. I mean, how would, just to return to Paul, such a significant figure, how would he have been seen by kind of Greco-Roman and Judaic intellectuals?
So he would have been seen as a philosopher, probably. The idea of a philosopher had gone through a lot of change in this era. Of course, there were still people who read Plato and Aristotle and existed in philosophical schools and pored over books, and that form of philosophy existed and never really went away throughout Greco-Roman antiquity, and indeed into Christian antiquity. But there are other kinds of philosophers. There are more, if you like, philosophers who are charismatics, as I call it them in the book. people like Apollonius of Tyana as the person who's most famously compared to Jesus, really, rather than Paul. These figures who travel around, they're always welcome. They seem to have a particular magnetic power. They can talk to people in authority without being cowed by them. They can deliver wise words. They're full of bon mots. They can apparently perform miracles. These are what the Greeks sometimes call holy men. Theos ane is the Greek phrase, who were borderline philosophers. And I think that's how Paul would have been received, as an inspired individual with a message which was inspiring but cryptic, somebody who could galvanize people in communities and change the dynamics of a community with his arrival, but also perform miracles as well.
So, and central to the transmission of this inspired inspirational culture, as it were, was writing and the book. I'm really struck by those sections in the book on the practice of writing. What did that look like in concrete terms, and how much was this actually a world of text?
The Roman Empire has been called by the Cambridge ancient historian Keith Hopkins empire by the book, by which he means that the whole bureaucratic structure was built around record keeping and narrative and tax receipts and the like. And the industry of the book, the book production industry in antiquity, particularly in this era that we're talking about, the first century CE and onwards, was absolutely huge. Papyrus was grown primarily in Egypt. It was harvested. It was, we don't know as much as we would like to actually about the factories that produced these reams of this stuff. But books were super important. They were important for empire, but they were also important for elite self-fashioning, as we put it. I mean, from the first century BCE onwards, if you were a Roman of any kind of standing whatsoever, when you died, you would have a portrait of yourself carved into stone, and you would be holding a scroll in your hand. And that scroll, which of course books were scrolls in antiquity, that scroll indicated your learning, which was a proxy for your social status. So books were prestige objects as well at the same time. The final important thing I think about a book was that it was a practical item. It was something that survived the author of the words. It was something that could be passed down into future generations. It could be read from to large groups, because not everyone, of course, was literate. It could be recopied. It could be re-edited. It could be rejinked as well. There's a lot of evidence for retooling of books in antiquity. So as the generation, the first generation of Christians, in inverted commas, as I say, they don't call themselves Christians, but Paul and the other apostles, as they realized that their knowledge needed to be transmitted down to future generations, I think, and this is a bit of joining of the dots, really, it's not, no one actually says this, but I think they turned to the book as a way of continuing the message. And Paul's letters, I think, were probably edited either in his lifetime or on his instructions, so as to become, if you like, a kind of corpus of knowledge that could be used to continue the message into the future generations. Because that's the really distinctive thing, as I see it, of about Christianity compared to other charismatic movements in this era. Christianity took steps to institutionalize early on, and the book, and having written texts, even though there was no idea of the New Testament this early on, so forth, sacred scripture, that's nothing to do with that. But the idea that you've actually got things that you can pass down to future generations, things that you can send off to different communities, a body of, if you like, kind of law, L-O-R-E, which could be consulted by future generations, I think that was absolutely critical.
It's sort of this real sense of it's such a pregnant moment, so kind of so much possibility. I mean, the popular image, I think it's important to discuss, I guess, is that this was an era of a violent persecution, when plucky bands of the faithful held firm against the might of the Roman state. Why has that story had such breathtaking appeal?
Well, it's a good story, isn't it? And Another thing that I talk about in the book, the last chapter of the book, is about this being the birth of novels. Everyone is telling stories in this era, and they're putting them down in books, and these books are sort of circulating around the empire. And Christians very early on get wind of this, and they start writing novels of their own. So in the second century, there is a novel about Paul and Thecla, a virtuous young woman, and it's presented as a kind of, is it going to be a love story kind of account? But it's not, of course. It's a story of Christian devotion. But yeah, so Christians do tell story. It's a narrative religion, as well as a religion of ideas. I mean, the Gospels are narrative text as well as repositories of ideas and teachings and so forth. And they have their own intrinsic drama in their plot arcs, which of course is the culmination in the death of Jesus. It is a story of persecution that launches the Christian faith, if you like. So that story is endlessly retold. So the story of every single martyr story, it may have other models as well. The death of Socrates is a very popular one, but it's always at one level looking back to the death of Jesus, the execution of Jesus. So there's a reason why we have this explosion of interest in the idea that to be a Christian, the ultimate act of Christian devotion is to die for your faith. And as I say, it's a perfect narrative structure. It's a very appealing narrative structure. Cognitively, it sits in the head very easily. It gives you a very clear, crystalline sense of the value of this material, particularly when the Christian message is often about survival into the afterlife. Your contempt for your body now, for your life in this world, is the flip side of your celebration of the life to come, if you like.
Yeah, there's so many complex things going on between, on the one hand, this idea of Roman Imperium, this empire without end, and then, I guess, on the other, world without end. And I wondered how that played out.
Yes, empire without end, as you know, is a phrase that is borrowed from Book One of Virgil's Aeneid, where Jupiter prophesies that Rome will have an empire without end. And it's not clear whether it's infinite in space or in time, whether it will ultimately become the global empire or whether it will last forever, or both. Presumably, that is entirely intentional. The Christian idea of the coming of the kingdom uses in Greek, and we have to remember that the earliest Christians are Greek speakers. They're not Latin speakers, so the Greek is their basic language of resource. They use the same language for the kingdom to come, God's kingdom to come, Basileia, as they use for the Roman Empire. So the analogy is absolutely exact there. And early Christian writers play time and time again from Revelation onwards with the idea that there are, if you like, two kingdoms. There's an earthly kingdom, there's a heavenly kingdom, and they explore the analogy, if you like, between forms of empire, forms of power, forms of control, forms of patriarchy that exist in our world and those that exist beyond. And of course, the easiest way of representing that is in terms of a disjunction, if you like. Our world is a world of injustice. The world to come will be a world of justice. But of course, the minute you present them as, in a way, comparable phenomena, then things start getting a little bit messy and paradoxical.
Yeah, while reading, I thought a lot about what it means to live in an age of revolution and about those kinds of paradoxes, and two other kinds of experiments sprung to mind, especially the French Revolution, when people very self-consciously attempt to remodel a whole population's idea of time and space at breakneck pace, and even in the first years of the Soviet experiment, where people were, you know, in this kind of bid to create a new human being, people are uprooted and moved over a kind of vast geographical space. But it seems to me that Rome's Age of Revolution manages to put down deeper roots. I mean, we're almost in July, which is followed by August. We're still using this calendrical system. We're still, in a way, being shaped by Rome's Age of Revolution. Did you think a lot when you were writing about some of those problems?
Yes, and geographically as well, of course, the idea of Europe really is, it's complex, isn't it? But it is at some level centered on the Latin West of the Roman Empire. and parts of the Greek East as well. So yes, we are inheritors of the Roman Empire in all sorts of ways. The word revolution is quite a controversial one for antiquity. There's a long tradition of people saying one shouldn't talk about revolutions in antiquity because then they're not like the French Revolution, they're not like the Chinese Revolution or the Russian Revolution, because they don't have these aren't it wasn't a nation state in the modern sense. We don't have the cohesiveness, we don't have the, if you like, the mechanical ability to affect people. So to put another way, the Roman Revolution, insofar as it was a revolution, was slower. It was more subtle. It didn't. It probably didn't have immediate impact for a lot of people. We have to remember that 90% of the population of what was to become the Roman Empire worked on the land, and whether they knew that they were now subjects to Rome or not, if you're working in, I don't know, North Africa, in the, or in rural Greece or somewhere, that's an open question. So it is a different kind of phenomenon, but I think partly because you don't have mass communication, you don't have police forces, you don't have all the technologies of a modern state. And we remember that the French Revolution, which is the, if you like, the founding re revolution, is took place in essentially in Paris and then radiated outwards. It was on a scale, it was much smaller, and it was much more to do with local dynamics than the Roman Revolution. The Roman Revolution really was about one individual's attempt to control political processes at Rome, and then use that his success in that sphere in order to cherry pick modes or established modes of imperialism that he saw in the Greek world, that he saw in Persia, that he saw to an extent in, I think, in Jewish scripture and so forth, and to sort of to build his own image on a vast scale, because he now controlled the wealth and the resources and the sculptors and the architects and so forth to create a new image. And I don't think the world had ever seen anything like the image making of Augustus. I think that was that's really at the heart of it. It wasn't an ideological revolution. It wasn't about imposing communism. It wasn't about deposing a king or anything like that. It was, as I say, it was a conjuncture of different things. It was the fact that you do have a state, a Roman state, which is exhausted by civil war and wants to come to some sort of settlement, and they decide, okay, we'll let Augustus be our boss man for now. And the fact that he wins at the Battle of Actium and manages to create this vast, wealthy set of resources to be extracted, and that allows him to create this sort of cultural revolution, if you like, which is a sort of propagandistic revolution, and the revolution in dress and revolution in time and space and so forth. But these are forms of representation. So it's at the level of representation and depiction and propaganda, if you like, that he creates his revolution.
Yeah, and so remarkably successful. I mean, there's a reason why we don't talk about that we're heading into Thermidor from Messidor or something, like the French revolutionaries wanted us to think. But yeah, just before we finish, I mean, what did you learn from writing this book? Was there anything you were particularly struck by that you kind of hadn't considered before?
That's a good question. What did I learn from writing this book? I mean, it took me an awful long time to write this book. I had a lot of false starts, and not just because of COVID. It's a really difficult thing to write about early Christianity, not least because we are so invested now in different stories of Christianity. There's a lot of, pressure either to tell celebratory stories about early Christianity or to tell debunking stories about early Christianity. So I felt that I learned quite a lot about those kind of impulses and how to resist them, how to not fall into, hopefully, I mean, people will be their own judges of this, but not to fall into the elephant traps of trying to narrate something about the modern world through this idiom, even though inevitably there are bits and pieces of it. I mean, Augustus emerges as a kind of a strongman populist in this book in a way that probably will resonate with people nowadays. But by and large, I try not to try to insulate the story from modern concerns. What did I learn most about? I think it was really just about the energy the entrepreneurialism, I use that word in inverted commas because they're not capitalists, but the nimbleness and the dedication of these pioneers of early Christianity is absolutely extraordinary. Just how quickly they picked up on the new opportunities offered by the early Roman Empire, and just how successfully they embedded, almost from scratch, not entirely from scratch, but they embedded a new way of thinking about the world that was at once innovative and bracing and fresh and unparalleled, and also looked familiar enough in all sorts of ways to Greek audiences for it to spread like wildfire.
Well, that's a, I think, a great note to end on with both the historian's discipline and that kind of entrepreneurial energy. So thanks, Tim. That was fascinating. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.